Yes, very welcome to our meeting. It's very nice that you want to join this meeting, this ISPAD meeting. And you will going to hear more about this ISPAD project, as you see it in program. My name is Helene Oppheim. Hello, welcome. And I'm working at the nurse department of Oslo Met, Metropolitan University now. Earlier, high school in Akershus. Get your time and find your place. Yeah. Some practical information. This meeting will be videotaped. You can see some monitors here, and that's because of we are going to share this meeting with our partners in Europe and with you. So it's an opportunity to repeat it as well. I would like to present our head of our department, Unni Hembre. She wants to welcome you.
Thank you, Helene. A very warm welcome to you all to Oslo Metropolitan University and the seminar Innovation in Simulation Pedagogy, and a very exciting title for a seminar, I think. Oh, but I think you nearly hear me without this one, don't you? So, yeah, I try. Yeah. My name is Unni Hembre, and I'm head of department at the Department of Nursing and Health Promotion. We are so thrilled to host this event. We have visitors from far away, both nationally and internationally. First of all, this afternoon, you will hear more about the ISPAD project. The ISPAD project is an Erasmus Plus funded project running from 2016 to 2019. And it's the Department of Nursing, University of Malta, coordinating the project. One of the aims of the project, if I understand it correctly, is to develop leaders in each participating entity in the use of simulation in nurse education. And the other aim is to create a set of simulation resources. And you will hear more about this just after me. It's a lot of partners, both from the UK, from four universities in Finland, that's good, and from Italy, and us from Norway, and you also have Ireland with you in the project, that's good. Our keynote address this afternoon is State of the Science and Future Visioning of Scenario Development and Assessment of Student Learning with Simulation. And a very warm welcome to you, our keynote speaker, Dr. Suzanne Hetzel-Campbell, Associate Professor at the University of British Columbia, School of Nursing in Vancouver, Canada. You are a global educator who use technology and experimental learning pedagogy. You have a very impressive curriculum. She has directed the development of simulation resources centers, led faculty workshops for integrating simulation pedagogy, and has edited books and published book chapters and articles on nursing education and lactation. We are so glad and so proud that you were able to be here with us today. And I also use this opportunity to welcome Kristin Wallen. She will have a speak later in simulation pedagogy and palliative care. Kristin is a PhD student, associated professor, and holds a master's degree in palliative care. She works at the Western Norway University of Applied Sciences. And to you all, I hope this seminar will give you inspiration and knowledge and the courage to use simulation in your teaching. Our students love it. Good luck, and thank you.
Thank you very much, Unni. It's also a colleague who are into this project with me. Maybe you know her, Kari Arntzen. But she was, unfortunately, she got a flu on Sunday, so she just bring us good luck with this meeting and best wishes to you. Now I'm going to show a video from our project. And this video had been taped in Malta. So it's a presentation from Malta about the project. After that, Kristin Wall will present her project. And then we will have a coffee break with something to eat outside. And after, we will hear Suzanne Campbell. So that's the program. And at the end, we will have time for some discussion. And it's nice because you are from different parts in the country and international, so maybe we can get some nice results from that discussion as well.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this presentation about the ICEPAD Innovative Simulation Pedagogy for Academic Development Project. This project is an Erasmus Plus project, which is coordinated by the University of Malta, together with other European partners. So, what is it that led to the development of the ICEPAD project? We know that there is growing concern about patient safety within our healthcare system. And simulation allows our students to develop their competencies whilst avoiding risk to patients. This is because competency can be achieved by the students without practicing directly on live patients, and also because it allows students to develop competencies in situations which are very unpredictable. An example of this would be developing competency in patient deterioration, for example, where it is not possible to ensure that every student encounters this particular situation. We know that we are living in a world where digital learning and digital information is very common. And so we must make use of ICT in learning and teaching. And these resources need to be developed in line with our pedagogies in order to train and educate our students, but also we need to ensure that our educators are able to develop and use simulation education resources. There are a total of 10 partners involved in this Erasmus Plus project, including the University of Malta, which, as we explained earlier, is the coordinating university. The partners include the University del Molise, Oslo and Akershus University College of Applied Sciences, Cardiff University, Turku University of Applied Sciences, JAMK University of Applied Sciences, Middlesex University London, Lahti University of Applied Sciences, University College Dublin, and SAMK. Besides the geographical distribution across the whole of Europe of these different universities, there is a wide array of expertise in the various aspects of simulation in teaching and learning across these different partners, which has allowed us to assist in the development of this project and in achieving learning across the different entities. There are two main planned outputs at the end of this ICEPED project. The first one of this is the training of simulation champions. Simulation champions are academics who are chosen from each of the participating universities, and their aim is to champion the use of simulation within their own university. And this is very important because this should ensure that simulation is used in teaching and learning well after the project terminates. The reason for creating these champions is also to allow these persons to train other academics within their entities, because simulation learning and teaching requires specific skills. The second output of this project is to develop a simulation kit, which we are calling a nurse kit. This kit will comprise three scenarios, which are designed for use with pre-registration nursing students across the different years of studies. And the aim of these scenarios is to allow nursing students to develop basic skills and key competencies in relation to the particular situations with which they will be presented. I will now explain what has been achieved to date. The first transnational meeting was held in September 2016 at the Valletta campus of the University of Malta. This meeting was used as a means to allow the different participants from the different universities to get to know each other, and also for every participant to learn about the administrative and financial management of the project. We also used it in order to establish the goals for developing the training program for our simulation champions and to set goals for the development of the nurse kits. Following this first meeting, a study unit was created with the aim of enabling the participants to design, implement, and evaluate simulation in higher education, and also to allow them to act as champions within their institutions. The aim was to assist in the dissemination of good practice in relation to the use of simulation, and also to allow the champions to act as mentors to other members of staff in the use of simulation. The study unit was developed by the University of Malta and Lahti University of Applied Sciences in Finland. It was given the study unit code NUR4151 in the University of Malta database and was named Simulation Champions Development for Educators. The study unit carries 5 ECTS and consists of blended learning. This blended learning included an online component and a 1-week intensive in-class session, which was held at Lahti University of Applied Sciences in June of 2017. The evaluation of this training session indicated that the participants enjoyed the diversity that was present across the different students in the class. This diversity included diversity in the extent of previous experience with the use of simulation. As a result, participants were able to learn from each other as the training program went along. The participants also reported that the online component was very useful and that the 1-week practical sessions in class and in labs were also very helpful in allowing the application of what they had learned online in practice. The second transnational meeting was held between the 21st and the 22nd of September 2017 at Oslo and Akershus University College in Oslo. The aim of this meeting was to obtain an update from the different three teams which were working on the three scenarios with regards to progress on the scenario since the first meeting, and also to discuss further development of the three scenarios. During this meeting, the target student cohorts who would be using the scenarios were identified. These cohorts included nurses in their first year of studies who were just starting clinical practice and so had very little experience in relation to nursing, nursing students who were at a more advanced stage and who were being delegated patient care under the direct supervision of a qualified nurse, and finally students who were about to exit the program and were consequently very close to starting their professional practice as nurses. The focus of each of the scenarios was also identified during this transnational meeting, and this included that overall the nurse kit would focus on comprehensive nursing care across the health continuum in a community setting, and that each scenario would build on the previous one in terms of complexity as explained in the following slides. In line with the increased complexity of each scenario, the first scenario focuses on a well person who has risk factors, and the aim of the scenario is to focus on the student's assessment and communication skills. So it focuses very much on the identification of potential problems, what type of actions are needed in order to meet this person's basic needs. The second scenario focuses on a person with a long-term established condition who is stable but who needs help in order to achieve self-care management. The third scenario focuses on a person with complex healthcare needs who is, however, still living in the community. The goals which have been achieved to date in relation to the nurse kit include the creation of a template across the different scenarios so that each scenario is consistent across the different working groups. We have established a theoretical framework which will guide the scenarios, and we have identified the learning outcomes of each simulation resource. We have also identified at which stage of the curriculum or course the scenario should be used, how much learning time is required on the part of the student, and also whether the scenarios can be used in interprofessional practice. The characteristics of the subjects of each scenario have been also identified, and the ICT required in order to run the scenarios have been identified, and we have also identified how each scenario will be implemented. The first scenario makes use of a video. This video includes a person with obesity, and the aim is to help the students to identify ways in which the required lifestyle behavioral changes can be identified and how they can assist the person to achieve these lifestyle behavioral changes. The second scenario also involves the use of a video, but this time the person has established type 2 diabetes. The scenario will allow students to develop the skills in helping this person to live with type 2 diabetes and to help the person to self-manage their condition. The third scenario makes use of a podcast. And this podcast includes a recording of the voice of a person who has just been diagnosed with cancer. And it includes three scenarios in itself. The first is a handover which discusses the discharge of the person to palliative care at home. The second part includes the person describing what it was like to receive the diagnosis of cancer. And the third part includes the person describing how she has moved to a level of acceptance of the cancer diagnosis. The third transnational meeting was held at l'Università degli Studi del Molise between the 30th and the 31st of January 2018. Every partner was represented during this meeting. This meeting was used in order to allow the whole group to review each of the scenarios within the nurse kit and to ensure that there was consistency between each of the scenarios. As a result of this, the nurse kit has reached the final stages of development. This meeting also allowed the planning of an evaluation research project, which will be used to see how effective the nurse scenarios are from the students' and educators' point of view. It was decided that a realistic evaluation methodology will be used, and the data collection tool which will be used in the study has already been identified. The final phase of this project will run between 2018 and 2019 and will include a trial of the nurse kit which has been developed in each of the partner institutions, as well as evaluation of the three scenarios. This will then be followed by a final conference in Malta in the summer of the year 2019, as well as by reports and dissemination of the results of this project across different universities. Working on this project has certainly been a very valuable experience for all of us. We have seen that the difference in expertise across the different universities has allowed the fusion of know-how across the universities, as many of the partners have extensive experience in the use of simulation and also have extensive resources which they have shared with the other universities. The main weaknesses, of course, has been in relation to the difficulties in working together virtually in between the meetings which are held face-to-face in different countries. This was mainly experienced in relation to the development of the nurse kits in view of 10 partners being involved in the development of three different scenarios. We have already experienced several opportunities as a result of the implementation of this project. The main one of these is the increased awareness of the use of simulation within the universities which are participating, as other members of staff learn about the project and start to learn about the use of simulation in nurse education. It has also given us the opportunity to learn about different healthcare contexts in different cultures. The main threats which we envisage is the availability of financial resources to ensure that the nurse kit will remain sustainable in the long term, and also that this collaboration which has been developed amongst the partners will be an ongoing collaboration and will not stop once the Erasmus Plus funded project comes to an end. Thank you for attending this presentation about the ICEPED project. We hope that you will continue to follow developments of this project, and should you have any experiences in relation to the use of simulation in nurse education or questions that you would like to ask about this project, we invite you to send these questions to our official email address, which is ispad@um.edu.mt. Thank you and goodbye.
Yes, that was the presentation for the ISPAD project from Malta. And me and my colleague, Kari, we've been working on this NurseKit 3 with cancer. And that includes palliative care. And we were so happy when we found Kristin Wallen, because she's been working with this for a while. And she is doing her PhD with simulation in palliative care. So now she wants to tell us, and we are very happy to have you here and that you want to share with us what you have been done. So you're very welcome, Kristin Wallen from the University of
Western Norway.
Western Norway.
Just a minute. Will you find out my presentation?
Okay.
No, I think you have to find out. You have to log in, I think. Or something.
Stian, he's at the in the neighbor house.
But can you switch, perhaps? Switch user?
Yep. No.
Don't you think you can try? Okay. Can we use your computer and I can find my memory stick?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Inside this one, enough of it. Also set it on proper listening. Okay, then I start and say thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure for me to come here and talk to you about my PhD project. about competence development for nursing students in palliative care using simulation. And as Helene said, my name is Kristin Valen, and I'm a PhD student here at the Oslo Metropolitan University. But I work and live in Haugesund. I work in these buildings in the town, and this is my town, Haugesund, where I primarily teach bachelor students in addition to my PhD studies. I have my background as a hospital nurse, working with lung cancer and COPD patients for nearly 20 years. And working with these seriously ill and sometimes dying patients taught me what palliative care is. And as the World Health Organization describes, palliative care promotes quality of life through symptoms control and other mental, social, or existential challenges for patient and relatives. And encouraged by working with this group of patients and their families, I studied to a master's degree in palliative care. And as a clinical nurse, I always was interested in how we best could introduce and teach our nursing students to care for the patient within palliative phase. And that led me to start working with nursing education 9 years ago. And here some good colleagues of mine introduced me for simulation as a learning approach. And I now combine my interest for palliative care and simulation pedagogy in my PhD project with the title End of Life Care Simulation, an intervention study using end of life care to investigate nursing students' competence development. And as you can see, I have three supervisors, Professor Ellen Karine Grove and Associate Professor Kari Tovrud Jensen, both present here today, working at the Oslo Metropolitan University, and also Annelise Holm, who's working at the Western Norway University of Applied Sciences. A project team, including four facilitators, are also associated to the project. And I am invited here today to share our experiences on how we developed a simulation intervention with palliative care focus and how it was carried out in this project. And the simulation pedagogy underlying will be explained, and hopefully it will provide inspiration for you in the work you are doing, whether it is in within palliative care or another field. But the findings in the project are not published yet and can therefore not be presented. My first article is in progress and hopefully in press during 2018. Not there yet. But before I go further, I want you to think back. Do you remember the first time you as a nursing student entered a room with a dying patient? Many of us do, because these are vulnerable meetings, both in terms of knowledge, skills, and it affect our personal feelings about death. And the fact is that nursing students describes that one of their greatest challenges lies in learning how to care for patients with palliative care needs and relatives. And nursing students often lack personal experiences in the field. In addition, palliative care and especially care for the relatives are poorly addressed in nursing education and curriculums. And the students feel unprepared for clinical practice. And this corresponds well with my experience as nurse and educator and motivated me to develop this project. And according to research literature, the education needs to focus on reflection and communication to help students become more prepared. And as we know, reflection in debriefing is the cornerstone for learning in simulation-based education. And simulation is recommended as an is recommended to prepare students to promote palliative care. And students who have simulated cases with palliative care focus reports increased confidence, improved communication skills, and learning palliative care principles. But very few studies have investigated whether skills acquired in simulation transfers and changes the student's behavior in clinical practice. So the aim of this study is to measure nursing students' knowledge, skills, and general competencies in palliative care during hospital practice, and further to investigate to which extent experiences from simulation prepare students to meet the dying patient and their families and contributes to realize learning outcomes. And the intervention was conducted spring 2017. During the second or third practice period, 55 nursing students in their second year voluntarily participated. And the simulation intervention was in the start of their 8 week of a medical or a surgical practice. And we have asked the following research question. What characterizes nursing students' own estimated level of knowledge, skills, and general competence in palliative care before and after simulation and after completed hospital practice? And to what extent do nursing students describe that simulation of palliative cases prepares them to meet patients in palliative phase in practice? And to what extent does simulation of palliative cases helps the students to achieve the learning outcomes in palliative care in hospital practice? And the study uses mixed methods with questionnaires and interviews. In the following, I will present what we have done, why we have made these choices, and what we have experienced on our way. When developing a simulation scenario, I recommend you to look into the INACUL's Standards of Best Practice Simulation, published in 2016. INACUL is an abbreviation for International Nursing Association for Clinical Simulation and Learning, and they present themselves at their website as the global leader in transforming practice to improve patient safety through excellences in healthcare simulation. And the guidelines addresses the various aspects of a simulation presented in the Jefferies simulation framework. So the objectives, the fidelity, the problem solving, how to support students, and the role of the debriefing is some of the aspects described in the guidelines. And when I started the project, I had a clear opinion that the learning outcomes and simulation cases could not just be my thought of what the student needed. And this is in line with INACUL's first criteria when designing a simulation. They say, perform a need assessment. What does the participant in this simulation really need? And no one is better to tell than the students themselves. And to ensure user involvement, we conducted 2 focus group interviews, one with third year students who had gained experience in practice, and one with their supervisors and teachers. We asked the students, what have you learned about palliative care and what has been challenging? Moreover, is there anything you wish you had more knowledge about before entered practice? In the same way, we asked our supervisors and teachers what they meant the students needed to know about palliative care. In addition to focus group interviews, we looked into national and international guidelines for palliative care, research literature, and learning outcomes in practice to clarify what's expected outcome at the bachelor level for a nursing student. And if any of you consider developing palliative care cases, which I hope you will, I recommend you to look into the white paper from the European Association for Palliative Care and the American Association of Colleagues of Nursing's recommendations, both describing core competencies in palliative care. And for those of you who are working in Norway, we have a national white paper with guidelines for palliative care in cancer care. Called in Norwegian, it's called the Nasjonalt Handlingsprogram med retningslinjer for palliasjon I kreftomsorgen. And all this information together helped us develop two simulation cases focusing on palliative care. And the selected topics is relational skills and clinical assessment. And the patient in both cases is Jesper Jensen. Jesper Jensen is 69 years old and has metastatic lung cancer. Jensen is in hospital with poor general condition, pneumonia and pain. And for his health condition, he receives antibiotics and painkillers. The doctor has informed the family of short life expectancy. And in the first case, the students meet Jensen and his wife when the nurse is taking away the antibiotic infusion and offer the patient some food. Jensen is tired. He has realized that he's going to die soon and is no longer interested in eating. But Jensen's wife has a different view on the situation. She wishes tube feeding for her husband. The second case illustrates when Jensen is terminal some days ahead. And focus this time is on clinical assessment of a dying patient's symptoms. And I'll come back to how the cases were carried out. We discuss the cases with a nurse from palliative care team at the hospital, and she helped us with the correct medications. And some of the benefits we experienced by user involvement was that the participants in this project describes the cases as realistic and relevant for practice. And in both cases, we highlighted the presence of relatives of the recommendations from the students in the focus group interviews. How to handle communication about the dilemma of no active nutrition on the one hand and treatment with antibiotics on the other was another topic described as essential both from students and the supervisors. And the next step was to develop learning outcomes. And this is the learning outcomes in the case focusing on relational skills. Here, the students were supposed to have knowledge on information about nutrition relevant to patient and relatives when the patient is dying, and can communicate about the patient's situation with patient and relatives, and can safeguard patient and relatives' autonomy and integrity according to ethical and legal guidelines, and general competence, show respect, understanding, and take other persons' situation and experience seriously. And to ensure that the purpose of the learning outcomes became clear, Dianacule Standards of Best Practice recommends us to use the SMART criteria for writing objectives. And they state that the learning outcomes should be specific. What exactly are we going to do and for whom? Measurable. Is it quantifiable and can we measure it? Achievable? Can we get it done in the proposed time frame with the resources and support we have available? Realistic? Will it have an effect on the desired goal or outcome? And time faced, when will this objective be accomplished? And I'm not sure that we always take the time to look into the SMART criteria to ensure that our learning outcomes are the best one. And to ensure that the learning outcomes and facilitator has this, to ensure that the learning outcomes, the facilitator has a central role to help the participants in their skills development and explore these thought processes in critical thinking, decision making, and problem solving. And the facilitator helps the participants with clinical reasoning, clinical judgment, and apply their theoretical knowledge. And this requires a facilitator who has the education, the skills, and the ability to guide and support the participants. When it comes to the facilitators in this project, the Copenhagen Academy of Medical Education and Simulation trained them in the simulation pedagogy. We had the pleasure of arranging a 3-day course with their course holders in our campus back in 2014. An INACUL best practice states that we need to have a facilitative approach that is participant-centered. We need to know the participant's level of experience and focus on the expected outcome. And we can't expect every colleague to be an expert on our domain. So to ensure that the facilitator team in this project were familiar with all aspects of the scenarios and learning outcome, we offer them a crash course in palliative care in Forefront. And information about previous lecture and curriculum were included. The facilitators have subsequently stated that this information, discussion, and participating in pilot testing, which I will come back to, helped them to be prepared, to be coordinated, and act with professional integrity. And the INACUL standards of best practice simulation states that the development of professional integrity, one has to foster and role model attitudes of professional integrity at all time, and follow standards of practice, follow guidelines, principles, and ethic of one's profession, and create and maintain a safe learning environment, and require confidentiality and of the performance and scenario content based on the institution's policy and procedures. And fidelity is essential in simulation-based learning. And Fritz Gray and Flanagan describes 3 aspects of fidelity, focusing on the equipment, the environment, and the psychosocial factors. And to maximize fidelity and make sure that all elements of this scenario related to each other in a realistic way, we invited 2 group of nursing students to practice to pilot test the cases. We tested the fidelity and learning outcomes, and the connection between the learning outcomes and the content of the cases. And the simulation team, along with other colleagues, also tested the cases twice. And afterwards, we asked them if the learning outcomes were understandable and achievable, was the case realistic, and did they have the prerequisites for decision-making and solving the tasks? And by pilot testing, the fidelity and connection between learning outcomes and the content of the case, we learned that we needed to reduce the number and content of the learning outcomes. Sounds that familiar? We discussed whether the learning outcomes were consistent with the content of the cases and experience really different reactions and alternative courses of actions. It was also a good way to test the time aspect. And the recommendations from the teachers participating in the pilot test was to develop user manuals in all parts of the simulation. So, in addition to the scenario manual we usually have, we this time also included a manual of briefing to the scenario, a written guide to the relative, and a debriefing manual with questions and content issues for discussion. The observer made their notes in a form showing the learning outcomes, and I will come back to how we use the manual. In forefront, the participants got information about the topics, but not about the details in the cases. They knew the patient case history, and that one case was about relational skills and communication with relatives, and that the other contained assessment of symptoms and clinical signs in a dying patient. It is, of course, debatable how much information one should present before the simulation. And the students in this project are familiar with simulation as a learning approach in their education, which also is important to consider the level of experience in simulation. These students have simulated several times before. And in this project, the participants were divided into a group of six and switched between being three observers in one case and three in action, and then they switched the role. And when it comes to the simulation activity, we introduced the patient's room. We used a living person in the case with relational skills and a mannequin in the case with clinical assessment. So we introduced the mannequin and actual equipment and medications and documentation. And to make the simulation as realistic as possible, yes, we used the teacher as marker in the case where the relational skills was practiced. It's more natural to talk to and get response from a person than from a mannequin. And since acting a dying patient can be considered as difficult, we choose not to use the student in this particular role. But by using a teacher, we also have to be aware of the power balance between the teacher and the student. Because placing the educator in a vulnerable role as a patient can make difficulties both for the student and for the teacher. But our experience in this case was good. And in both scenarios, the student played the role as a nurse and relative. And in the first case, the student who had played the relatives received a written guide of questions she or he could ask about her husband's health conditions, marked here with the dark green and the column with the dark green. Few students have experienced being a relative to a dying patient, especially as a wife. And we found it useful for the students to have these questions and that they lower their shoulders. And the facilitator manual here in light green had examples on how the nurse could respond to the questions that were in line with guidelines for palliative care. And this served as a reminder for the facilitator from the crash course and helped them to focus on core competencies within palliative care in debriefing. And when the student trained clinical assessment, in the second case, they used a Lærdal Simen 3G mannequin, a high-fidelity mannequin. And the mannequin was set up with chain-stroke respiration, high pulse, low blood pressure to indicate changes in his physical conditions. And we used makeup to mark altered skin color on extremities, and the patient had urinary catheter to indicate low production of urine, and the manual hair are more as we usually use. We also included a manual over the patient's symptom in the case with the clinical signs, so that the facilitator had the symptom, the observation, the assessment, and actual treatment in a guide. And these are just shown you as an example on how we did it. And simulation-based learning ties well with Kolb's theory of experimental learning, when the participants in action got a concrete experience. And during the simulation process, the participants reflect, as Donald Schoen would say, in action when they interact between the learner and the environment, and on action through debriefing, where they have a more abstract conceptualization. By including an application phase in debriefing, the participants got an opportunity to prepare an active experimentation and redo. And I highly recommend you to let the same participants simulate the cases twice. We experienced many changes in terms of knowledge, skills, and changed attitude in the second performance. And this reflective thinking is driven by questioning. The facilitators and the participants question in the debriefing. But the quality of the questions and how it posed will determine the breadth and depth of the learner's thinking and response. And with that in mind, we developed a debriefing manual with questions and current issues for discussion that could be asked to enlighten the learning outcomes. And here are the learning outcomes in the second case, where they're supposed to do the clinical assessment. And this manual was made since palliative care isn't a facilitator's educational field and was meant to be helpful. But our experience is that it turned both ways. Some appreciated the backup questions, while others thought it took the focus away from what the student wanted to discuss. And again, we have to remember to have a facilitative approach that is participant-centered. And the simulation process of actions and reflective thought can give a more nuanced way of thinking about further task and transfer of knowledge to practice. And according to Maseru's theory of transformative learning, this transformation is focusing on the process of using a prior interpretation to construe a new or received interpretation of one's experience in order to guide future action. And this process critically reflection on the learner's and in this process critically reflection on the learner's own perspective of option is essential. And to foster transformative learning, we need to safeguard the participants and make a safe learning environment in all parts of the simulation. And we experienced that the coordinated simulation team interacted positively and affected the atmosphere in the room. And the moral philosopher Henri Frédéric Amiel said back in the 1800th century, "To know how to suggest is the great art of teaching." And I think we have to remember that in every step of the simulation. And the facilitators in this project were aware of the student's double vulnerable role, since both palliative care is a sensitive topic, and simulation as a learning approach can also be frightening for some students. And the facilitator told the participants that the focus was on learning, not assessment. And especially that the simulation had no consequences for the evaluation of their praxis period, since that was one of the students' concerns. And transformative learning should be our goal in simulation learning, and to know if transformation occurs, we need to evaluate. And since I can't tell you about the result from this study yet, I want to share with you a story from one of the pilot tests. You see, one of the students participating in the pilot becomes stressed in the situation. She was confronted by the wife about that the patient would die if he didn't start to eat soon. The student focused on the practical skills, taking away the antibiotic, and she had no answers to give the wife. And suddenly the student said, "I don't know what to do. And I don't know what to say. And then she left the room crying. The other participant did not quite understand what happened, so the other nurse took over and the simulation continued. And one of the teachers went out in the hall to talk to the students who had left the room, and together they came back. The student resumed her role as a nurse, but more retired. And in the debriefing, we were determined that she was welcome to share her experience if she wanted, but that it was okay just to be present. And first, the student was quiet, didn't want to say anything, but after a while, she chose to show some of her experience. And after the simulation, she talked more with the teachers alone. And then she went up to the evening shift at the surgical department and met a similar situation the same afternoon. And according to herself and her teacher in practice, she this time chose to go into the situation, she dared to talk to a relative, and use the experience and advices she had received in the simulation. And I had to add that this was a young student, a third year student, but with no former experience in palliative care or a dying patient. And her supervisors that did not know about the palliative experience, about the simulated experience, she was quite impressed that she handled the situation so good. And for us, this was really motivating, continuing the work with the project. And given the sensitive nature of palliative care and the risk of emotional distress during or following the simulation, as this example shows, it's a good thing to offer follow-up support to participants in this type of simulation. And if we should evaluate the simulation-based learning this student was a part of, we had to decide at what level of evaluation we should use. And Kirkpatrick and Kirkpatrick's model of evaluation is commonly used and depicts four sequential level of evaluation. The first is reaction, measures participant satisfaction with training. Learning measures knowledge, skills, and attitude gained from training. And the third is behavior, measures changes that occur as a result of training. And finally, results, improving quality and safety, increased return on investment following training, such as productivity, revenue, and employed retention. A research literature shows that most of simulation evaluation are on level 1 or 2. And there is a need to document changes in knowledge, skills, and attitude occurred as a result of training. and for example the transfer of learning to practice and the impact on patient safety, satisfaction and development of practice. To sum up my presentation, I would like to use the Kirkpatrick's 10 requirements for an effective training program, which I think goes good along with simulation-based learning. They say that the program should be based on the need of the participants. We do not always have time to have focus group interviews before we start the simulation. That's probably a PhD student's privilege. But I think we all have the time to ask some of the users and go to guidelines and ask the questions, what do the participants really need? And the learning objective is set. Remember to use the SMART criteria. Go through your learning outcomes. And the program is scheduled at the right time. And I want to argue that we have to include simulation as a part of practice and combine simulation and practice so the student can continue near in time. And the right people is attending. How do we motivate our students or participants for the simulation learning? Kirkpatrick and Kirkpatrick also says that we need to have effective instructors. By including a crash course, user manual, and pilot test, the cases in this project saw the effect that helped the instructors to have a professional integrity. And effective techniques and aid is one of the requirements, and I think we all can agree that simulation is an effective technique. And accomplish the program's objectives. The learning objectives, the learning outcomes, has to be accomplished in debriefing. And Kirkpatrick and Kirkpatrick says that we have to satisfy the participants. I want to add safeguard the participants, because I think a safe learning environment will have a great impact on how the learning will be. And if we safeguard the participants, I'm sure we will satisfy them. And the last requirements is evaluate. We need to document if simulation changes the participants' knowledge, skills, and attitude according as a result of training, and if it transfer to practice and have an impact on patient safety. And then I will say thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Christine, for a wonderful presentation. And if you have some question to Christine, she might answer that. Everything is very clear.
Then I can ask a question. Do any of you do any kind of simulation according to palliative care? Yes. And where is that? Yeah.
Maybe you can say something about it.
We have had a pilot study in Gjøvik, and we have combined the postgraduate students with their an interdisciplinary education program in palliative care, with bachelor students in nursing and
ergotherapy.
Ergotherapy? Ja, dere skjønner det, ikke sant? And that was very successful,
yeah,
and very interesting to see the combination between students on different levels and from different professions.
Okay, yeah. Interesting.
Thank you very much. Great. Any comments? More comments? Okay. So then I just want to give you a symbolic gift. So thank you very much. Thank you for coming. So now I want to present Susanne Campbell, and we are very happy that you say yes to our invitation for this meeting. And we are very happy to have you here. And as Unni told us earlier this morning, or afternoon, Susanne Campbell, you have a very long experience into simulation, about 30 years.
30 years
teaching. 30 years. Yeah, okay. Yeah. And we are very happy that you want to share some of it with us today. So you're very welcome, and you will present yourself.
I will.
A bit more.
Thank you. Hey, hey. Gott etter middag. Tak for invitation. That's as far as I can go. I tried to write out my pleasure to be here, learning from your work, and it just became all jumbled. I am in constant awe when I go internationally and meet colleagues who speak so fluently in English. I know often you feel you don't, but compared to my ability to speak Norwegian, it is marvelous. Je parle français un peu. C'est tout. I feel after Kristen's amazing job this afternoon that I have not too much to add, but I will broaden the perspective a little bit. I have been a practicing nurse for as long as I have been a nurse educator. I'm a women's health nurse practitioner. I first started in high-risk obstetrics, so you will see much reference to my maternity cases, and really was enabled to have more global relations 13, 15 years ago at the University, Fairfield University, where I first met these fabulous colleagues from Norway, and really started looking outside the U.S., and that's why I have emigrated to Canada 6 years ago. I will sit for my dual citizenship, hopefully apply for it in July, and within the year I should be able to have it. Our new Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, has done amazing things for immigration and making it much easier, and at my age I don't have to take the exam anymore, so that was a really nice addition. But we did have a workshop yesterday with nursing faculty and practice partners. I've gotten to sit and talk with quite a few of you in the room, and I'm really amazed. This project itself is showing such breadth of foundational work, collaborative work, and I really think that it is going to have amazing results. I think you have many partners globally who will really enjoy being part of all of this. So I want to focus a little bit. I did incorporate some of what Kristen reviewed, so I can go through that really quickly because she explained it so well. And I will be focusing a little bit more on the assessment piece. I have also spent probably 20 years of my life on instrument development and evaluation, and I'm in process of doing some of that now as well, so very happy to share that with relationship to simulation. My list of disclosures has gotten somewhat embarrassingly long, and I need to tell you, in Canada, we have to be very careful about being transparent. So when you are a book editor, you do get royalties on your book. By the time the U.S. and Canada tax me on it, I might see a dollar per copy. And the lactation core curriculum, there's actually four of us, and we agreed we get one little stipend up front, but the rest of any of the monies that come in royalties is going to go back to the International Lactation Consultant Association and their learning, education, and accreditation stool pillar to help for lactation programs globally. Editorial boards, many of you may sit on them as well. I've got some advisory boards that I sit on, but none of it is meant to be a product or an advertisement during my presentation today. So I want to talk a little bit about the present landscape in developing scenarios. As I said, Kristen gave such a beautiful example of the thoughtfulness. Yesterday when I asked if anyone knew of Anaxyl, nobody did, but I found out later that Kristen did. And I am a member of the Anaxyl organization, and I'm hoping in the next few days to find out that I'm going to be their new vice president for international affairs. So that will give me an even broader excuse to start bringing all of our collaborators globally together around nursing simulation. I'll compare a little bit of innovative teaching methodologies. We have been very focused on more high fidelity based and in a sim lab, and I want to broaden your perspective of what I define as innovative teaching, even if you want to call it simulation, and then talk a little bit about how nursing educators can use more creative methods and compare and contrast some of the advantages and challenges while we're assessing students with simulation. We know that we need to innovate in nursing education globally. In 2010, the Lancet report came out from the Institute of Medicine that showed us the decreasing numbers of prepared health professionals globally. And when I hear about how many nursing students you're educating in Norway, I'm thinking you're going to be okay. It feels like you have a pretty high number. In North America, we're projecting within the next 5 to 10 years, 1 million nurses retiring. And we are not educating to replace that retirement. I think Kristen is also a wonderful example of how we should be looking at our clinical practice partners and identifying those who will be excellent nurse educators and mentoring them into the world of academe. I feel very fortunate that I was mentored in early and that I was able to keep my clinical practice by being with students in clinical and a separate NP practice, so I maintained my skills. I think that's important for nursing faculty. We have an aging population. We're worried about quality and safety of care. We are worried about healthcare professional shortages, and there's an increasing expectation for interdisciplinary work, and I will be focusing on that a little bit today as well. But there's just national, political, and global pressure for us to change how we're educating, not to mention our millennials who are demanding a different form of education of us. So what does that translate to in academic nursing? I have been talking with you in Norway. You have a very unique opportunity that your nurses are still helping to educate your students. In North America, we must provide a clinical faculty member for every cohort of students. So I know your hours are between 2,400 and 2,500. Ours are about 1,200. Still, when you multiply 1,200 hours per 120 students in my program, and the hospitals now will not let us have more than 6 to 8 students max per faculty member. You do the math, and then you add the union state that I live in, and it is very expensive, and that's why part of what's pushed North America towards this simulation is looking at clinical hours and how we do that. We've also changed what we see as foundational knowledge for nursing students. The quality and safety and health informatics, we've got violence prevention, we have trauma-informed care, and we have that whole cultural aspect and culturally sensitive care with the patient center that has changed over time. And I think it makes us look very carefully at how we're leveling the education, what we offer when, and then on the scopes of practice. Now, I know you do have master's prepared programs. We had some great representatives from intensive care yesterday. In North America, we have nurse practitioners, and they are educated at an advanced practice level, but they are primary care providers. They diagnose, they order labs, x-rays, whatever is necessary, and they are able to prescribe. In Canada, RNs in their scope of practice have a baseline prescribing capability. So, and yet this is juxtaposed to Brazil, where I have colleagues who the RNs did have these capabilities and someone got in and is trying to pull them out. It is a turf war. And a very fine line. Do I have any physicians in the room? Okay. And physicians are my best colleagues. It was a culture shock for me. I came from Connecticut and a very interprofessional. My first job was in an academic medical center. Doctors and nurses were equal, and we worked side by side and included nutritionists and physios, and we had whole interdisciplinary teams. And I moved to Canada, especially West Coast Canada and British Columbia, and there are definitely different worlds. It is changing slowly. I have seen changes in 6 to 10 years. But I think we do not have enough general practitioner physicians to care for our population in British Columbia. Without nurse practitioners, patients are not getting care. They have no access to the system. So that was long-winded, but I didn't realize you didn't have NPs here. This is reiterating what we've heard said. I love the century-old quote, but how do we redefine nurse educators to become designers of learning experiences? No more sage on the stage, but guide by the side. How do we help students facilitate and use and apply the knowledge that they're gaining? And that does require an increased use and comfort level with technology and with not always having the answer. I start my classes by saying, what I'm telling you right now, you might Google and find out a study just came out 2 minutes ago proving me wrong. But how do we help them search for information, identify credible information, and move on with that? I'm not sure if you are familiar with the quality, safety, education, and nursing competencies, and I'm trying to think now. I believe it was 2010 or so. These have become embedded in much of our nursing curriculum in North America. Even at UBC, with our new curriculum, we have incorporated all of these 6 competencies. I will be making the slides available. They should be mailed to you, and these links should be available. But again, if you Googled Qs and competencies, it would come up. Do the 6 competencies there make sense to you? We're not going to go down and read all the little pieces, but patient-centered care, I'm thrilled to hear that that's a focus in Norway as well. Teamwork and collaboration, evidence-based practice, quality improvement, safety, and informatics. The other piece that we can pull upon is the WHO Collaborative, the World Health Organization, for interprofessional practices, the IPP. So if you look at these, even compared to the Qs and competencies, there is some overlap. That's how do we take simulation to the next phase, where we are bringing students together interprofessionally and having them work on teamwork and communication and patient safety. But that critical reflection is helpful as well. So I know we will be given time, and this piece is being videotaped, but I'm very curious about how you're developing partnerships between your academic and practice partners, because it's something we've been working very hard on and come up with quite a few different strategies. I know we have some community partners here that I met who are looking to build collaboratives, and we have been successful in North America in doing that in a few ways. It sounds like you have some similar components. But the challenges, opportunities first, are to do it in situ when our students are physically on the units with staff available, if you have the resources and equipment there to do it with, or develop more of a day-long mass disaster training or mass trauma event where you're bringing students from all different backgrounds together. But the challenges with that are time management and resource allocation, and it takes somebody to be in charge of planning all that. I find in our province it's the nursing faculty that do it. We have formed in BC a simulation technology working group, which incorporates academics from very many disciplines working with simulation and practice partners and some of our IT folks. Do many of you have IT folks incorporated into your planning and work? I wasn't able to hire at Fairfield an IT person until I got a government grant and was able to write into that for that line of 8 hours a week or whatever. But to find the resources and the people who will help and champion you is important. And we found that we did a survey in British Columbia and everybody was doing their own thing. And even now, as I'm trying to pull people together, every health authority has their own sim director and sim lab, and nobody's talking to each other. So we have started to form these opportunities for collaboration. In November, we all met in Prince George. It was my first time far north of the country, snowing in November, probably similar here. And we called it a mini simulation user network, SUN, and I've heard some of you out here are having similar things. And that was a huge success. Again, with our geography, it's hard for people to travel and get to all these events. So we do have to do some in locations. We have an island to think about. We have the north and then the interior, and then the mainland is where most of us are situated population-wise. But part of this collaborative task force helped us to bring together the health professional educators and practice partners. We looked to identify some simple beginning common goals, and one of them was patient handover, and we created a small online curriculum for patient handover and then did some testing with that and had simulations attached to it. We were looking for ways to consolidate resources, and one of the best ones is scenarios and how to best share those. And talking with some of you, that's a goal that you all would like to have as well. And then for collaboration across the province, we're hoping to develop some research programs. I don't know how easy it is for you to get money for educational research. We call it the Scholarship of Teaching and Learning. In the United States at Fairfield, after raising an initial $1 million to build our lab, over the next 6 years, we were able to get over $9 million in government funding for various anesthesia programs and, you know, a nurse practitioner. We just framed them all differently and just kept getting the money in. In Canada, there's none of that. If you aren't doing almost bench science or real rigorous nursing research, you're not going to get a dime. And so you have to get very creative about where you look for funding with that. The other benefit if you bring a collaborative together is you can focus on interprofessional because you've got these partners there. And I would really encourage you to do that. I know for us as well, the funding streams for medicine and nursing are very different, and I have found that when I am partnering with medicine, the small grant I got for my communication research was through the Faculty of Medicine because it was a provincial level, that there is monies there. And also the medical students in their last year are all required to do a project, and they are really excited to work with nurses. So again, it's that way of nurturing when they're young. But you really do need to develop a strategic plan. So I'm really curious, you know, with this Norway European Union, I'm only here in Norway meeting folks from here. Got to meet Anna, so I'm getting a little bit of the Portuguese background in Portugal, and Frederica and I will have more conversations from Italy. But I'm really curious with this European Union how you will keep it going. And when you look at this list of questions, that 45-minute introduction answered most of them. It told me the details of the ice pad, the three clinical scenarios that will be involved, and what your hope is to maintain collaboration and go beyond just the scope of the product. They call Canada the country of pilot studies. And I have learned now living there 6 years the reason why. Because the government is great at funding for a pilot study, but then the funding stops and whatever was accomplished goes away because there's nobody to support it. In the U.S., when you get government funding, you have to demonstrate how the project will be sustained when the funding stops. So that was incorporated. So I would encourage all of you, whenever you're looking for funding in that, think about how you're going to sustain what's happening. Okay, so are there components to the future of nursing education? We're here talking about simulation, but honestly, don't put tons of money into the high-tech resource allocations of simulation. That's just my Suzanne Campbell advice. After moving to Canada, where the resources were much different, we're never going to build $1 million lab, and working with colleagues in South Africa and South America, you can do simulation without all the bells and whistles. Simulation is a tool. It is a method. And Kristen and I had fun talking with Anna this morning because she's doing simulation. She doesn't think she is, but she is doing simulation. There is debriefing. There is role-playing. There is modeling. It doesn't have to be with a high-fidelity mannequin. So just, you know, to broaden and think outside the box, the virtual simulation is a huge up-and-coming factor in North America right now. Now, there are companies, and again, I'm not selling anything here. I'm just giving examples, and they're very expensive. I think we can create our own, and I think we can come up with international collaboratives where we're sharing them. And that's what I love in Canada as well. When you create something, it's to share with the world. The eBaby that's here that you'll be able to link on is a serious game that my doctoral student in Brazil, I came onto her committee and she came and did a sandwich doctorate with me for 4 months in UBC. Her advisor had developed it. It's for premature infant in teaching nurses how to care for, so hydration, oxygenation. Natalia, for her dissertation, did the skin care component of it. They have been able to adapt it to teach parents for key components, and they are moving it to a mobile app. Because in Brazil, people may not have a computer, but everybody has a mobile phone. So, you know, I think that's why I'm encouraging us. I think even with our students, one of my colleagues at UBC, Bernie Garrett, is really advanced in this virtual reality. He has created an app. When students walk into our lab, they hold their phone over the QRS code, and it shows them what the item is, what it does, what the parameters are, everything they need to know about it. Just walking through the lab to be prepared for the simulation that they're running. There's multiplayer virtual worlds and single user products like Second Life. As tech savvy as I am, I haven't gotten into those worlds yet, but I know that they're going to be the future for our students. So just again, to think a little bit outside the box. Part of the challenge when we are educating our students is that there's a whole professional development education that has to occur. And I really liked this compassion model because I think it dealt well with keeping our students compassionate and worried about their well-being in the center while recognizing what they need to be learning to be effective healthcare providers and how they should be thinking about shared decision-making with patients and their relatives and family members, and how do they monitor their own emotional response to that and Anine, I know you're in the room, is looking at that with her doctoral work right now and debriefing. And I think those are things, especially as Kristen described that palliative care setting, huge emotions. And we don't know what students come with, what their history is, if they've lost family members, if they have been exposed to violent deaths, who knows. The issue with this is that our students are also working in environments or going to work in environments that might inhibit some of that compassionate model. And I'm not sure, we do have very short staffing right now, especially in specialty areas. And part of that is I think the environments are so toxic that the students just have trouble surviving there. They think they really want to work there, and then they get there. That discontinuity and fragmentation of care is an issue, and they get there and realize there are conflicting values. We all went into nursing to work with patients, be present with patients, and the present environment with the acuity level of patients and the amount of documentation and other works, the complexity of medications and treatments and care, that makes it difficult. So flexible learning opportunities are a good way to think about preparing students. Those other two slides, I just wanted to ground us in the fact that we know what our ideal is and our goal, and we know that education is a unique time for students to be prepared, but there's also a reality for what they're going out to. At UBC, we've taken opportunities to incorporate flexible learning, which means that we've created modules that are web-based and have interactive components where feasible. And we've also looked at hybrid simulations. So that's not the high fidelity. That is, in my area of obstetrics, there's a limbs and things pelvic model that we can do birthing with. And a lactation simulation model that just came out that I'm using in some of my breastfeeding work. Or a partial trainer, so they're putting in a chest tube or an IV, and then you take them into a simulated environment with the full patient, and they've already practiced and done the hand-eye coordination for those skills, so they're not so focused on that in the same simulation factor. They really need to be prepared before they come in, and that means as faculty, we do need to set the objectives and the pre-briefing. What do they need to read? Are there videos they can watch? How will they be prepared for what they're coming in to? And in the classroom setting, we can use personal response systems to get a sense. I mentioned Poll Everywhere because I believe that that's free. We had incorporated clickers for a little while at Fairfield. That was rather expensive, and you had to keep track of them and batteries in them, and it was complicated. Now with the Poll Everywhere, that's a text phone. The students send a text on their phone on an answer, and it plops up in your PowerPoint the percentages of different answers. You can address sensitive topics that way. Students have an anonymous way of answering, and you can get a sense as faculty, are they really understanding this or not? Do I need to spend more time on it or dig deeper as to why they're not understanding? And again, you can do that in a web-based module fashion with just a few multiple choice questions that give them feedback if they get it right or wrong. That's what we did with our communication module. Then the clinical lab piece. The way that I have heard you describing your use of scenarios and simulation here has been the low stakes, has been the learning opportunity, facilitation, more formative learning. There is the high stakes option, which means they are evaluated when they go in. And so it is a fine line as to how you want to do it to protect students' sense of safety and not being fearful, and yet have them take the situation seriously enough and get a true evaluation of their skills and competencies. So as an example, most of the scenarios I run, I will have an evaluation checklist and usually have of a couple of students, one of them observing and saying, did they introduce themselves? Did they check the patients who they said they were and ID band and all that? Did they wash their hands? You know, simple things. But it's not graded. Whereas for our nurse practitioner students, when they get to the end of their term, they go through what are called OSCEs, Objective Structured Clinical Evaluations. And these are live standardized patients, actors trained in rooms that they have to go and see as a live person, and they are graded on it. They must pass it in order to sit for their nurse practitioner license. In the province of British Columbia, it is required. Some other places, it's optional. Some other nursing programs I've seen will actually test out students at the end of second year or third year or fourth year and make sure that they've met all the competencies. There are different ways that people use it. The competency testing takes much more resources because you need to have people paying attention and evaluating. Another option is to videotape it and evaluate it after and have the students evaluate themselves. So there are lots of ways that you can do that. We know that there are gaps, and again, Kristen touched on this, to the research we have on simulation. We haven't identified outcomes well. We haven't translated how teaching with simulation means improvement in clinical behaviors, change in attitude or thinking, and better patient outcomes. We also have not done a good job in simulation research of describing the design and the setting or the role of participants and facilitators. And the research rigor of the research we have out there has not been as strong. Now, Betty Mariani was the first author on this book, and she created a simulation research paper evaluation rubric. I have joined her team, and we've tweaked it and recrafted it some. It is up on the ANAXA website as well. Students are using it before they put their papers in, but we will be looking at 120 research articles that were published between 2014 and 2017. This study she has the gaps identified in was based on 2012 to 2013, I think, maybe 2010 to 2013. We'll be looking at 2014 to 2015, and I'm hoping we've identified some of these gaps. But we probably will be combining both. And this is just in the journal Clinical Simulation in Nursing. But that is one of the top impact factors journals for this area. So in my mind, those of you who are wanting to do this research, these are the three key areas to focus on. Looking at how it's being used for interprofessional education and whether that's affecting safety outcomes, and then developing reliable and valid instruments, which is my bias, and the methodological rigor. So when I hear the research, especially that Kristen and Anine are doing, the rigor is there. They have been very careful in how they're planning out their studies, and that's what we need for our upcoming research. There are many theories, and Kristen alluded to quite a few here and used the Kolbs, but I guess for me, it's just, please use a theory. Whatever work you're doing, it doesn't really matter. There are many out there. Just use one when you're doing your work because it will be more believable. The other thing I was a little surprised about is sigma, theta, tau. Now, my colleagues, is someone here from Dublin?
Do we don't have a representative from University College of Dublin. I was there this summer, and they have a Sigma Theta Tau. They hosted the International Congress this summer there. But a lot of people think of it as either American or North American, and it is an international global honor society. It is the only nursing honor society. So we need to be looking at it. There are leadership programs, there's grant funding, and for students, as far as reputable, when we look across North America, the students who are Sigma Theta Tau members, it's usually the top third of a class that are invited that need to show leadership, excellence, and scholarly capability are the ones who go on to become our leaders and movers and shakers in nursing. Have you heard of GAINS before, the Global Alliance for Leadership in Nursing Education and Science? Again, that's a global organization, and I want to say one of our Canadian colleagues was president at one point. And then the International Network for Doctoral Education in Nursing is another group that is looking at, and very globally minded. So there just may be areas you can examine, because work on simulation is being done within all these groups as well. So if you compare and contrast the clinical skills and team leadership development, what I wanted to do was just give you a quick example. Kristen did a very good job outlining objectives and focused on undergraduate. I'm going to compare my postpartum hemorrhage with being for undergraduate students for clinical skills building, and then being done interprofessionally for teamwork and leadership building, just to give you an idea. That means the objectives developed are going to be different for both cases. The prerequisite learning will probably be a little bit different, and the outcomes you expect to see, as well as the debrief, will be different. These are the ANAXL best practice standards. They just added the simulation operations, and I was going to go and get the reference, but if you go to the link for ANAXL, and I didn't put ANAXL in front of that, but that's who it is. Developing simulations to meet those standards is important. And as I said, this was beautifully outlined already. Setting objectives, pre-briefing, facilitating in a safe and open environment, evaluating with either criteria, checklists, or peer evaluation, and then debriefing how facilitators can be helpful and the reflective component to that. If you take apart the standard 9, that gives you the list of all the areas of simulation design that you can look at. I think we can be proud of the nurses, because when the SSIH, which is the International Healthcare Simulation Group, which is mostly the physicians, looked at our standards of best care, they said, oh, that's fine, we can adopt that. So I think globally we are all referencing each other. So in developing the simulations, I'm just going to, as I said, go through quickly an example, hopefully making it concrete. Setting the objectives, having a glossary of terms is important, using valid and reliable instruments if available, and having a template for the design. So this is just an example, and this has been updated in my 2018 book, a copy of which, and promotional coupons for this conference are down there. But I updated it to be Canadianized, so it's totally international now. We used all the international policies and guidelines surrounding postpartum hemorrhage, which mostly are European, but World Health Organization. But just to give you an idea, you want to have, who are your participants? Who is actively involved in this simulation? For this one, there's one nurse examining the patient, one nursing assistant, a family member, and an observer who is taking notes on the evaluation checklist and on communication. The process just gives students a general sense of what's going to happen when they come in the room. You have to have a basic patient history of what's happening with that patient. And then as part of the assessment, you want them to introduce themselves and do a safe exam, identify anything that's out of the ordinary, and once they recognize that there is a problem happening, because I'm telling you it's all a postpartum hemorrhage, I'm telling them it's a postpartum assessment, to deal with that as quickly as possible. So part of the scenario chapter template, and three editions ago when we first wrote the book, we found our authors really needed a template in order to organize how they shared their story. And this worked very well, and how many years later, and Axel came up with the best practice standards, and we really had covered them all back then. Here's an example of how objectives might look different. For the undergraduate student, obtaining a history, examining past history of the labor and prenatal course, looking for signs and symptoms, debriefing would involve some self-reflection for areas they mastered, areas they need to improve. Whereas if you're doing more team building, you're going to have objectives looking at how do they collaborate with team members, delegate, coordinate the care involved. Do they outline steps for emergency? Does someone step up as the leader and start delegating? How do they notify other people of what's going on? And then how is the team mobilized to maintain safety of the mother, but also care of the family member who will be obviously very upset? In the debriefing process, you could use self-reflection and a concept map, why they did what they did, how the team worked together, where holes and gaps were, and you want, you know, the team members to provide feedback to each other. But again, instead of being focused on a skill assessment, how does one nursing student do what needs to be done, it's how do you bring the team together. So you could see the first one might be offered early on undergraduate for a normal postpartum, and then by the end of the term you could bring in the interprofessional one with some colleagues to participate and ratchet up to more of a team training. The team training one we've actually done in hospital in situ with members right on the unit floor in the middle of their day. And so that's another example. You can convince your practice partners that this would be good competency training for everyone and make sure the crash cart is where it needs to be. Are any of you doing that with CPR with practice partners? Do you see some of that happening? Yes. They have fun with it. Yes, yes.
They are still on the unit, and right, they're still thinking a little bit about the patients, but still, it's very well liked. And it's more, we talk about different things, like where's the
cart?
How do you open the doors if you have, you know, numbers?
Yes,
locks,
yes, right, right.
You know, things like that we would never realize if we are in the same center.
Exactly.
So it's a little bit of a different experience.
Well, and that is a great selling point, and I'm thinking we should have brought the mic up to capture it all. Where are you located?
In Iceland, in Reykjavik, Iceland.
And I need to talk to you. Because in North America, we're using it as part of our hospital accreditation processes, and that's how we get the practice partners to sign on. But again, it takes your champions. And I've had students I've mentored, one that was in the ER room, and she just took the bulls by the horn. Because again, what I found is the physicians create the simulation and they've got it all set and together, and nobody's asked what objectives might be for nurses. They're all very medically oriented. And nobody's asked whether the nurses are available or not. So even if they're using the sim room in hospital, nurses can't walk off the unit and leave their patients, and the time hasn't been. So that's where we've resorted to in situ. And exactly what you said, that's more the system discovery of what are the issues within the system that are not going right. Another place I see it happen is when an adverse event occurs, and then you do the root cause analysis and deconstruct it to figure out how might we do this differently. But nurses are leading that. They're the point of care. They're there managing, supervising, moving all the parts. And that's where I think with simulation in our nursing schools, we can empower our nursing students to be leaders, to speak up and bring people together in a non-threatening way and understand we're all in this together. So in those two scenarios, I tried to just give a nutshell of the difference between a clinically different demonstrate assessment of a postpartum woman to maybe a communication, educate the patient and partner regarding maternal status and plan of care. In crisis situations, we have very good research. Cheryl Beck is one of the leading midwives in the Politan Beck research book, who was a close colleague and mentor when I started out at the University of Connecticut, and she did a study looking at trauma through the eyes of the beholder, and it was mothers who suffered infant deaths. She had groups in Australia and New Zealand that shared with her, and the trauma was related to how the healthcare professionals mentored and journeyed with them through the experience. If they were given full information and transparent and had time to grieve afterwards, it was a very different experience from if it was just an emergency. And healthcare providers are devastated when anyone dies, let alone a baby. So, finally, with the interprofessional, you're really looking for team mobilization and the handover skills, the communication during the event, and what do you have to do to build that team skill development? A great example of interprofessional in situ is the birth study out of Scotland, and they took this limbs and things pelvis model, it's how I found out about it, and carried it to sites across Scotland. I'm trying to think if they might have gone to UK as well. Anyhow, they practiced shoulder dystocia with the actual teams in the environments, and they demonstrated decreased morbidity and mortality of mothers and infants just by the team training with this simple simulator. So those are the kinds of things I think that you can think beyond just nursing education. This is for all of healthcare and how we can improve. So I won't spend a lot of time on the pre-briefing. Just to say, I am a true Bandura person. Both my master's and dissertation, I used Bandura's self-efficacy model, and I think that has a little bit to do with my maternal child and self-care setting and aurum that I was raised in. But I do believe that vicarious experience is a very valuable way for our nursing students to gain experience. And in that sense, as educators, role-playing and role-modeling are very key and important. We expect students to walk into a situation with a patient in a crisis event, never having seen anyone else deal with it that way. So I really am taking home the work Kristen's doing, looking at that therapeutic relationship and giving the students cue cards, examples of, okay, if this is the question that's asked, here's how you might think about answering it, and getting them to key into nonverbal reactions and how do they manage those pieces. So vicarious can be done through videos as well. We're doing a pilot while I'm away. We're going to run our fourth term nursing students, they've got one term left, through the postpartum hemorrhage with watching a video of it first. I have a professionally developed video that we have done, just to see if that helps, because I've run it with them in the past and we got to the end, they stumbled through the whole thing, and we said, what would have helped? I was teaching with Wendy Hall, who helped me rewrite it, and they said, could you just show us So we did. Pulled in a stretcher. I got under the cover like I was the mother. She pretended to be the nurse. We called another nurse in, and we reran the whole thing live with real people. And they were like, oh, that would have helped so much if we'd seen it first. And they don't have to see it done really well or really poorly, but... And then the static task trainers, and I think I alluded to that, you get the idea with that. They're so focused on the skills, taking a blood pressure, inserting a catheter, other components, that it's important to look at that. I'll segue for half a second. My daughter is an English PhD, now assistant professor, with rhetoric and composition as her background, but her dissertation was on how nursing students develop a sense of professional identity through the use of simulation. And good colleagues at Seattle University let her come in and play in their lab, and she interviewed their students. So, of course, I'm her mother, and I read her whole dissertation. But one thing that she uncovered in the discourse analysis with the focus groups with the students were the gender issues surrounding intimate care. And I think that it's something we as nursing faculty know and experience, but we haven't really given attention to. And the quick example is a male student with a female instructor and a 75-year-old that needs a catheter inserted. Or a female student with a male instructor and a 20-year-old male patient that is a motor vehicle accident and broken femur and needs a catheter inserted or a bedpan. So that intimate care level and how gender issues should or shouldn't matter, but if we help students unpack them, deal with them, acknowledge it may be a little uncomfortable, you're a health professional, this is the type of care we're providing, how can we make the patient as comfortable as possible? So I think the pre-briefing piece is key with that. And just as an example, when I was pre-briefing them for the clinical skills portion, the undergraduate students, I had them review an assessment of a postpartum patient. Look at different reasons for why patients bleed after delivery and come up with some ideas about what you'd be looking for to identify each. And look at key points. Can you identify what you would need to do before you call someone? What would be serious enough that you would need help? I had a video for them of a normal postpartum assessment. They had some reading assignments, and they took a quiz online for basic knowledge comprehension before they went in. Whereas if I'm doing it for team building, the scenario I had was with a group of surgeons, and I didn't have any time to give them reading assignments or show them videos, so I had to do a live briefing of a history and background of the patient, and, you know, one of them had to be a nurse, and they'd never been a nurse before, so I think a nurse may have come in with us last minute and helped out. They were scared to death. None of them had had a postpartum patient, let alone a postpartum hemorrhage since medical school, and they were like, what are we doing? But we said the focus is team. You can do the team. Review the scenario in detail so they weren't worried about all those clinical components. Gave very specific roles with scripts and kind of walked them through the room and event. And then as it was unfolding, we were videotaping and we were able to go back in and debrief. And I just lucked out. We were doing this in Vancouver as part of a graduate medical education program. And the first group that I did it with, we had a pilot in the room. I don't know how he got there, but he was there. And he was amazing because in aviation, they do all this team training stuff. We got to do it better in healthcare. And then the second time, I had the head of anesthesiology from University of Washington, who was the expert on interprofessional education. I'm like, okay, you can do the debriefing and show me how it's supposed to be done. It was marvelous. What I think I love most about simulation, and I'm looking at the faces and thinking of this European collaborative you have right now, we learn from each other. There's no right or wrong. There are different ways to approach. We're all in different contexts. But it it's such a rich learning opportunity, and we can make our students and our colleagues curious again and realize why they went into teaching. I come from a family of teachers. My husband comes from a family of teachers. It's in our blood and in our system, but teaching is supposed to be fun. And our students today want to have fun. They're curious. They're techie savvy. They will help us with this. So facilitating, again, that safe and open space, it really depends on the faculty in the room. And this is the piece where I will say a small caveat. I'm really good at pretending I'm confident even when I'm not. And faculty who are not and who feel like they need to know everything down to the line and not be wrong about anything are going to have a really hard time in simulation, because students are going to say things, do things, find things, and give you a reason for why they did it that way that's pretty palpable. And if you aren't ready to go with the chaos and the flow of it and have it in your mind, you've got to get through X, Y, Z, not going to work too well. So I think developing faculty, helping them feel confident, helping them have fun and see this as a non-threatening experience. The other plea I want to make is for the use of volunteers. Again, in medical schools, there is money for standardized patients. They are very expensive actors. Our nurse practitioners will do some interprofessional scenarios with the medical residents who have paid for the standardized patients, so they get the benefit of it. We pay for it with the OSCEs. But we have an awful lot of retired doctors and nurses out there who love their universities and would love to come and be playing and teaching with some of the, maybe, maybe not. That's what we're using in British Columbia. We have patients. We've got groups called Patient Voices and Quality Patient Safety Groups that are dying to come in and work with our students. One of the ways they do that is as health mentors. That's a program we offer as a capstone where students from all different backgrounds, and we have 17 health professions at UBC. So we can have a medical student, a nursing student, a PT, OT, speech pathology, nutritionist, social work, all working with one live patient. And this health mentor walks them through their experience with the healthcare system. They sometimes go on visits with them. They visit them at home and see how their house is set up. And then as an interprofessional team, describe, you know, what's happening with the patient. It is amazing, the eye-opening and what they learn about each other's roles. The suspending disbelief piece when you're facilitating, I think you really need to think about ahead of time what amount of suspension of disbelief and how real does it need to look or not. I'm okay with a blood sugar monitor that has a taped number to it. And I talk about the cues when students are moving through the simulation. Those can come as a voice of direction. If you have a way to feed a voice into a room or just outside, by the way, the crash cart's in the right-hand corner, or, you know, something like that. Or they can come through the mannequin or the patient volunteer. You know, if a student just starts doing something, what are you doing? Who are you? What, you know, what's happening here? And just enough of a cue to get the student to stop and think, did I ask permission to take your blood pressure? Or, you know, yes, I'm going to take some blood now. This is for. So scripts are very important too. And I liked the more broad general script that you shared with us, Kristen, because it's just giving students an idea. They can, you know, simulate it. Again, no right and wrong, but just an idea. If someone asks, that's what needs to be done. So I want to jump in a little bit to the evaluation component. you can develop the criteria ahead of time. You may make up some checklists that reflect your objectives. You could use peer evaluation where they monitor each other. I do have a plea for valid and reliable instruments, and as time goes on, we are getting more out there. But these would have been the checklists for the clinical skills and the team and leadership one. Did they introduce themselves? Did they obtain a history? Are they identifying signs and symptoms and communicating with the family? Did they call for help? Whereas with team, you want to see specifically how were they collaborating, what was the communication like, and how did they debrief afterwards. And debriefing, we got a good note too. It does depend on the scenario objectives. There is no one way for doing it. I'm fascinated because when we did our tour of the sim lab yesterday, we ran into the paramedic students finishing up their full day of simulations. And the teacher's standing there saying, yeah, I've been here since 9:30, haven't done a thing. The students run it all. They set the rooms up. They have written the scenarios. They debrief themselves. And he said they are so much free. And Carmen was in the workshop yesterday for those who were here sharing with us. But they're so much more free in their debriefing. So the only concern there I would have as faculty is I would want to have an ear out and just make sure that it's accurate. But the way that they were testing each other and looking up in textbooks and, you know, confirming conflicting thoughts, that's how they're learning. And they're really then embedding and applying that information. So I'm challenging us a little bit. I've been nursing faculty for a long time. I have a really hard time letting go of content and letting go of letting students go. So I think that sometimes we need to trust in that learning process. And, you know, there are a couple of examples that I'm getting a little more specific. What I really appreciated, we do want to get a sense from people involved in the simulation of the challenges they perceived they faced during the simulation itself. And that could just be, it didn't feel real enough. I couldn't react to this patient mannequin that has no facial expressions toward me. Or it could be, I forgot how to take a pulse. I forgot, you know, that simple. But then moving beyond that emotion to how would you do it differently next time? Or do your peers have any suggestions or thoughts about how they might have done it differently? Can they identify what the basic diagnosis for that situation was or the problem for that patient and kind of outline quickly the priority items for care? In a critical situation like postpartum hemorrhage, 2 to 3 minutes that patient can die and exsanguinate. So it's pretty critical that they're doing something. And then what other information might they have wanted? Was there labs they could have gotten or more of a background history? And then the biggest one, and again, this was one I would run with 3 or 4 students live in the lab at the beginning of my lecture with the rest of the class watching in the classroom. And then we bring the 4 students back in and we debrief all together, and that's what I teach on for the rest of that class period. It was a great way to incorporate. I knew they had done the preparatory reading. I knew those that were in the simulation were ready to go. They felt a little bit put on the spot, but it was all a safe learning experience. And if classmates during the simulation had ideas, one jumped up and said, they're not massaging the fundus. I said, okay, you be the midwife. Go in and tell them they got to massage the fundus. You know, that type of flexibility to allow them to be playful with it and to support each other. Is nursing education here as competitive as it is in North America? It's highly competitive. We are turning students away. I have probably 500 applicants for 120 slots. And when they get in, they are high
A students, incredibly driven and very competitive with each other. And I keep saying to them, you're going to be working side by side someday. Let's ratchet it down. So I'm getting the sense, because I didn't see any nodding of recognition, that's not the case in Norway or Italy or Portugal. Okay. Difference then, the debrief in the team building would just be more focused on the teamwork, the effective communication, how they might change that style. I mean, so sorry to see you go. See you in Vancouver. That's the goal. How did the teamwork and communication of the group create barriers? That is a point to look at. Were there hierarchies set up? Was somebody afraid to say something they saw that they didn't think was accurate or correct? And how did the teamwork enhance the communication? For both of these, during the simulation, I do encourage students to speak out loud and sometimes speak about their thoughts. And if it wouldn't be natural to do in front of a patient, I would say, step away and just say, this is me now thinking out loud, but I'm really concerned about what I'm seeing here, and do I need to be checking something else? But just to, especially with the team building one, to incorporate that they have to keep talking to each other and checking in. And when a leader's identified and tells someone to do something, they need to report back when it's done and update on the assessment. And that's a way you're updating the whole team and the family and patient. So again, it's something we're not always comfortable with. So these are more in common questions, and I have to say the group that was sitting in the classroom observing the simulation had work they had to do in front of them. They had to come up with a care plan. They had to think themselves about what they would do differently. And at one point I had them evaluating the people in the scenario on communication, their therapeutic relationship. The other thing that you described in your manual, I would do in a one-sheet paper, for the faculty member running the scenario, I'd say, okay, look at this patient history. Now, I have to say, for the 2018 version, we have found the research that disproves that redheads bleed more easily. I'm sorry, I've been a maternity nurse a long time. I still think there's something there. But this patient was multi-parity. It was her fourth child. It was a very large infant, over 4,000 grams. I almost said kilograms. That wouldn't be good. Had a difficult labor with medications, Pitocin or oxytocin, which again fatigues the muscles. Had a vacuum-assisted delivery with an episiotomy with a fourth-degree laceration. So actually, when a student just looks at that piece, it could be uterine atony, it could be lacerations, it could be a hematoma. Any of those are possible with that. Again, the bladder distension would have caused more uterine atony, and the risk of infection was there. But these are all, in this debriefing guideline or teaching note, it was all a way to come out of the simulation, do the debriefing about the feelings and the emotions and what they would have done differently, and then go into teachable moments. So, okay, you decided to massage the fundus. You must have suspected uterine atony. What in the patient history would have indicated that they were more likely to have uterine atony at this point in time? Did you check the laceration to see if it was dehist or bleeding or other aspects? Did you look for a hematoma? How would pain from that have been different so that you could judge that, yes, this was uterine atony, and then know what you needed to do? Did you pick up on the full bladder? She gets a quick report of, oh yeah, Pete sometimes last night, but no updating things. And then what were some of the confounding variables? So does this make sense to just have a guideline, again, for consistency, so that every time this is run, you have a little bit of information? So that was it as far as examples of the simulation.
The other component is to talk just a little bit about how we're evolving the simulation research. So I do have the link here. The ANAXIL best practice standards, you might get confused because you'll see 2015 dates and 2013 dates of when it first came out. And what they've decided right now is that it is a live document. So it lives on this website, but as they make changes and whatever, it will continue to grow and change. The National League for Nursing in the U.S. worked with ANAXIL to create a document called Debriefing Through the Across the Curriculum, and that's available at the link that's here. And then I mentioned the Society for Simulation in Healthcare as the other major international organization for simulation. They've created a wonderful dictionary that, again, ensures we're speaking the same language. I didn't even think of whether the thing was working here, that it might allow me to show these things. Okay, this is the repository of instruments, but that's not what I meant to send you. Okay, I'm going to be sending you all two other links through Helene and group here. This is the repository. So if you are looking for a valid and reliable instrument to use for simulation research, it lives here, and this is open to the public. So you can go and take a look at this site. But Kim Layton, who was previous president of ANAXIL, has created an evaluation of healthcare instrument sites, and my health communication tool is going to be up there very soon, but she has one that is a student evaluation of the simulation experience that we're using at UBC as we're incorporating more simulation, and colleagues at Langara in British Columbia are also using. So you can find that site. Oh no, here it is. Sorry, I did give you both. There it is. The Evaluating Healthcare Simulation. And what they're proposing with this site, so they have a facilitator competency rubric, simulation effectiveness tool is the one that we're using with students. And then I was talking with a couple of you from the community about the organizational culture readiness survey. So this will help looking at administration, faculty, everybody, how ready are they to embrace this and to recognize the potential it could have? So mine will be here, Global Interprofessional Therapeutic Communication Scale, GITCS, very soon. I just emailed Kim yesterday and said, it's ready. When can I put it up? It has been translated into French in Belgium. We're testing it with colleagues in Montreal. It is being translated into Brazilian Portuguese and possibly Portugal Portuguese, or comparing, and Mandarin with colleagues in Hong Kong, and Punjabi with colleagues in India. So that is my other goal. If I get this VP International Affairs, I want to see us have an international component on this website where we are creating instruments that are reliable and valid in all the languages, because I think that will be key to our research and future moving forward. Any of these others, just to give you a few examples, and again, I'm not proponing the book, but this was the 2013, which some of you have told me you do have the copy of. Multiple patient medical surgical scenario, a central venous catheterization pilot project that was medical residents and student nurses that was really well done. My colleague at Fairfield did this operating room fires with the nurse anesthetists. So I know you have those here as well, and that might be a good one for team training and a quality safety process. And finally, an older adult with abdominal surgery. My opinion, you can take any simulation you have and anyone you find anywhere and incorporate an interprofessional component to it. It is very easy to do, and with the similar competencies in Norway, I think it's important to be thinking about it. So the last piece is, how do we start standardizing what we're doing with simulation? This ISPAD project is a fabulous start. I've talked with you a little bit how I'm trying to devise collaboration within my own province right now, but hoping that might reach out across Canada at some point. The one that I just added, there are simulation certificate trainings. SimOne is a Canadian organization that has just formed, and part of it was in reaction to previously the only certificate programs were in the U.S. and they were very expensive. And Australia has one as well. Everyone is jumping on the bandwagon, and I think what I'd like to say to you is, for your European Union, create your own. You know, it doesn't have to cost a lot of money. You follow best practice standards, you identify your champions and have them possibly trained, and what was described in that project about how that was done, you've already done those pieces. But I think that this is one way to standardize. I guess the caution is we can't assume that all faculty are just going to be able to walk in and do this. It does need preparation and professional development and support, and it should be done in baby steps. And then I go back to the fact that every nursing faculty has been teaching like this forever. We've all used case studies. We've all used examples of our own clinical experience. That's all this is. That's it on steroids, you know. It's just you have bells and whistles with the mannequin that talks back at you and blinks their eyes. Use a live subject to do that. Get playful. Bottom line, it's about critical thinking, clinical reasoning. How are they determining what they do? There is no textbook case. You and I know. Any patient we've seen that we thought was going one way, something will be different and happen. Our students have to be prepared for that inevitability. There are also certifications for simulation centers. And again, in BC, I'm just kind of saying to my colleagues, it's just something you get into that has to be accredited every year, and there's money attached to it, and we have so little money for sim anyhow, I'd rather put it into growing our own and doing our own piece. So I think there are ways to bridge the practice education gap to get more of the nursing students we need through in a learning in a manner that they are more comfortable with by these creative learning opportunities. We do need to think about how we're standardizing those opportunities, leveling them to be appropriate for students, and then assessing and evaluating them to be able to demonstrate to our supervisors that this is a worthwhile approach. You'll notice I didn't get into the whole substitution of clinical with simulation comment. We talked about that quite a bit yesterday, and it's a Pandora's box. I think we need to proceed with caution with that. My experience has been when students are exposed to simulation prior to and concurrent with clinical experiences, and then in the classroom, I bring back what they're seeing and doing in clinical as well. They're more confident and get more out of their clinical experience time. The other caution, because in North America, our regulatory bodies are state boards of nursing in the U.S. and our Canadian provincial state boards are looking very carefully as far as our nursing school accreditations at how and where and when we're using simulation and being very critical of it, not wanting to count it as hours. And my only caution with that is we've never required clinical hours to be judged at that same critical level. And many of us know that a lot of time in clinical, students are running circles looking for the clean room or a supply that's missing or whatever. So I think we need to be careful, and I think we are beginning to demonstrate and will continue to demonstrate that students are gaining knowledge. We've proven they love it. they and faculty are satisfied with it. They have better confidence, or they think they're more confident after it. What we need to prove is that it transfers to their clinical practice and that they're retaining the information. So that's the other piece that I'm beginning to think about. How do I incorporate testing afterwards to make sure that they've retained? And honestly, there was a point in the States with one of our hospitals that, because of insurance, whatever, the number of open heart surgeries was going down, and the staff in that unit was worried about losing their skills, so they worked with us at Fairfield to create a simulation. And, you know, I think there are opportunities for events that are uncommon, but when they happen can have serious adverse situations. Those are the ones we can pinpoint with students and staff and practice so that they're ready. Or the perfect example of when something doesn't go quite right on the unit, coming back, re-examining it, and doing it. I didn't give that as an example, but in part of my clinical conferences after a seven-hour day on the unit, instead of just sitting in a circle and talking about what they did, we would go into the sim room in the hospital and rerun some of the hard cases that they had had that day. So the sky is the limit. Your imagination with where and how and when you use this, and finding partners that will do it with you. But using theory, critical reflection with the debriefing, and focusing on competencies rather than hours in is a big piece. I think if we can be measuring competencies and demonstrate that our students have mastered the competencies, then we're not going to have to care. It's going to take one student 10 hours. It's going to take another 30 with a similar skill. So let them do what they want to. And that's my beautiful British Columbia. So part of this will be just references in the organization piece, and that's it. Questions, comments? Are you going to run facilitation from here?
Yes.
Do we have time?
We have the time.
Okay.
So, are there any questions or comments? Thank you very much for this fabulous.
They're not getting away with this. We're walking the microphone through. I want to hear examples of how people are doing either interprofessional or debriefing or team training or something. A quick example from everybody. Pass the microphone. Yeah. They are here. They need to work. Tell us who you are and where you're from, unless you have to run. Hi.
My name is Tore Carlsen. I'm a PhD student, and I'm supposed to implement a team training program in the nursing.
Wonderful.
A Bachelor of Nursing program at my campus. It's called the Team Steps program from United States. Have you heard about it?
And yes.
Do you know any nursery schools that use Team Steps program?
Many are incorporating it as part of their team training. And, of course, the University of Washington's right down the road from me right now. They're having good success with it. It's well laid out and gives you guidelines to follow. Do you have a specific time period that you're using it in as far as the student level?
I think to be a team player, it's a question about maturing. So I plan to implement it from year one to year three.
Perfect. Mm. Perfect. I can talk with you more about it when we're done.
Thank you.
Okay.
Somebody else who wants to share something, what you are doing?
Folks from all over.
Yeah. Brett? Yes, we are so many.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Richard Olson. I work at Oswald County Hospitals. So we're at not the high schools, but we're at the hospital. So I'm together with Gru. She works at a simulation center with me, and Lars. He works at the same
center. Hi, nice.
At the hospital, we have simulation with an acute medical team once a week. We take different cases, like different cases with the whole team training in simulation.
Okay.
Otherwise, we have a lot of different programs. Instead for STEPS, we have a Scandinavian program that's called PROACT. So we have at the different at the different hospitals here. And we think about incorporating the third year of nursing school studies.
Okay. Right now it's been mostly medical residents or?
Well, you have at the
hospital.
At the hospital, mandatory for all nurses and actually for all nurses and doctors and the surgical wards and medical wards.
Okay. And so you're looking for students, maybe?
We hope that the students start in the third year. We incorporate in the third year of studies. And when they're at practice, when they're at the hospital, so we encourage that they participate in the different simulations we have at the hospital with the normal staff.
So you do them weekly?
With a MAT team. Yeah, we call MAT team our medical acute team.
Okay, and is it the same time? Is it in situ and surprise?
It's in situ. But it's different times. We try to get either Tuesday, Wednesdays, or Thursday. It depends how much simulation we have.
Right.
So it's usually from 9 to 10. We go through the whole case, and then we take a debriefing about 30 to 40 minutes debrief.
Wow. So it's a two-hour time period.
Yeah, well, we want to get it down to 1 hour.
Okay, so 20-minute scenario and 40-minute debrief,
exactly.
Which is what they suggest.
Right.
And there's doctors and nurses in the acute, so they are collaboration and
excellent
working together. And our experience is that the nurses are much more in the same lab than the doctors, but just in this area they are working together. So that's improved the medical patient's outcome, I think, already.
So how are you demonstrating that?
So that's what we really want to do is start on research and develop and be able to report it.
Yes.
With numbers and just not their own experience of this. We think we are doing better. Like we want to actually record it.
You wouldn't be alone because that's all we have out there right now. And I think it is hard to make that leap to how do we measure the differences. In something like shoulder dystocia, you can look at baby infant mortality and other aspects. But it's so many confounding variables and other things to take into consideration beyond the simulation.
Otherwise, I have to agree with her from Iceland. We have done that, but not we don't do it regularly. But we have done different at the different hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
We come with a rescue Annie, throw it on the floor. Okay, now you have a cardiac arrest.
Yep.
And then they have to. The experience we got there, it's amazing actually. Some places where they felt the defibrillator was working, they found out actually the battery was taken out because there's So there's a lot of things that improved after we did these simulations. There's one thing if you do it at a course, another thing, how does it work in real life?
So that's where you can document for evaluation.
Right, exactly.
That you can get documentation of.
So all this mail talk.
Yes. Wonderful examples. And I think that's what I want to incorporate. After 5 years as a dean, you walk in the room and everybody's like, no, I'm faculty again. That's where I want to be. I'm not a global expert. I'm just fortunate to have met so many people around the world and stand on the feet of giants who have built up this simulation over the last 10, 15, 20 years in nursing. But it is that openness to learning from each other. And as I say, 2 days here, I'm in awe. You all are doing an amazing job. Definitely on the right path, and there's so much synergy that we could be sharing so the burden won't be so heavy. We don't have to do this alone.
Are you guys comfortable sharing the Italian and Portuguese perspective? I would love you're here, and everyone else needs to hear.
Okay. I am Federica from University of Verona, Italy. And so we are using a lot of simulation in the undergraduate program. Within the 3 years, they change. We have some lab on the first year about the clinical skills, very technical.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then we go through by a relationship with the patients, and we are using some of... you know that we in Italy we are very creative. So we asked to our parents to go to the for the lab. My father is one of them.
I love it.
Yeah.
Dad, come on in.
He acted like a patient with a chronic illness.
Yes.
And
yes.
He is very excited to work with the students. So we are very creative. So
yes.
Because we
yes.
don't have so many money to spend in that. So the main concern we have in this kind of stimulation is that the old academic professor, most of all, they think that the simulation can replace the clinical practice, and so
we are
aware because our students doing a lot of clinical practice during the 3 years of bachelor in nursing. Is that major
concern?
What are
the hours required? Do you have an hour
it's
requirement?
It's 1,000 hours per year.
So 3,000.
Yeah. It's wow. bigger. It's biggest.
That might be similar to Brazil. I have to double check, but...
I don't know. I work in British Columbia, but we have many, many hours of
in North America,
practice.
1,200. Is the norm. That's why our students have trouble coming over to Europe to work, because especially UK, they force them to make up those clinical hours. I don't know. Again, in North America, we have to pay clinical faculty for every hour.
Yeah.
That is the piece that makes it...
We don't have to pay them. And so this is the main difference, I think. And so this is the reason of this concern. Do you think they are right? So this is, but the simulation can replace.
No, completely. I think we have to be cautious on both ends of the dime.
Yeah.
I think some simulation will enhance clinical experiences, and there may be a little bit of a substitution ability, but the other side of the coin is government saying, oh, this will be cheaper, we'll just run everybody through simulation, and I think there's a danger to that as well.
Okay.
Definitely.
So,
was I seeing a hand over there?
Okay.
No, sorry.
My colleague.
Very helpful, Frederica. Thank you.
Yes.
No. Anna.
So, good afternoon to everybody. My name is Hannah. I'm from University of Leiria, Portugal. So, I was this morning sharing some of my simulation experiences. We do have some mannequins, not high-tech mannequins,
right.
So we use a lot of role-playing in case study scenarios. And as the same as Frederica, we have some, because I use them a lot in mental health, mm-hmm. also in palliative care. And in mental health, there are a lot of young patients that would like to share their own experience with their colleagues, or mostly of their colleagues. So it is a good case scenario, mm-hmm. but sometimes I may confess that I'm a bit afraid about the reaction, both ways. We tried some experiences, and because we have these volunteers, it has been working well, but mm-hmm. sometimes I wish I could have some mentorship from expertise in order to assure that everything stays okay after the simulation, because this is not this has an impact,
yes,
good or bad,
yes,
or but has,
mm-hmm,
but has it, and in palliative care it's quite usual that both in theoretical class and as simulation, but especially in simulation, I have a lot of students going out of the class crying. Some of them come to me afterwards, and there are a lot of experience,
okay,
and not that well done experiences,
right,
and well resolved experience. So some of them, as their parents heal, or their lost sibling, or lost someone in the family, and I wish I could have some support. I try to, because we have a group of psychologists that are in the campus, mainly to orient the students in motivational issues or class
counseling,
issues.
Counseling, yeah.
But counseling. But we are asking them to some support if we notice that some of the students are with these emotional expressions during simulation.
So your university doesn't have student services that would incorporate counseling?
Yeah, they do have.
But is it hard for students to get access? Yeah, that's
and
ours
it's
too.
It's hard for students to recognize that they would need some help.
Well, and I think sometimes as nursing faculty, too, it's hard for us. I have to remind a faculty member to take off their nursing hat, that they are faculty, and if they are picking up on this in a student, they need to recommend counseling. We have highly improved because the mental health issues in North America have, with college-age students, have become a real issue and problem, and we're beginning to improve. I'm hearing what you're saying, and I'm thinking the high-risk obstetric unit I worked on, at least once a month, a nurse practitioner, psychiatric nurse practitioner, came for us staff.
Mm-hmm.
We were losing moms and babies. It was, you know, not an easy place to work, and the manager held down the floor for an hour. We knew we had that 1 hour at least once a month to debrief and get support and learn to support each other in a collegial way and deal with some of the issues. So maybe that's something we need to begin role modeling even as nursing faculty, of our students recognizing the need for and then coming up with a way to cope and meet that need. It doesn't always have to be counseling. It could be a walk in nature. And I think our colleague from Iceland.
Yeah, I just want to comment your question. Because of our ISPAD project, in this nursing kit number 3, we are focused on that that case, that the students, they have a problem to accept and to count on their problems with palliative care. That's especially around palliative care, but we have some session that they focus how they can handle this problems.
So that may end up being helpful.
Yeah. That's maybe. We haven't tried it out yet, but next month we are going to try it out. And we think that we in the faculty, we have no focus on how they can be helped and what they can do for helping themselves in difficulty to handle patients. And that will be also general, not with only palliative care. But in this case, it's palliative care. Yeah.
Well, and I'm thinking it fits with that intimate care gender issue as well. It's just making it a safe environment for students to acknowledge and unpack some of that and come up with coping skills.
Yeah, so it should giving them some tools.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Good to know. I know our colleague from Iceland had another comment.
Yeah.
Thank you. This has been really interesting, both Christine. I look forward to your papers to see them, and also listening to you. It's been quite an experience. And I work at the university hospital, so I'm coming from a little different side. But I also work at the university or the School of Nursing, but primarily at the hospital. So we are doing a lot of simulation, interprofessional simulation. Mm. That's sort of our focus, and it's a relatively new simulation center that we have, but we decided all along to do this interprofessionally. So I don't know if some of you may have heard of the basic patient safety modules that are coming out of Hong Kong. So we have incorporated that, and everybody is supposed to go through that. And it has a very small simulation component, but still there is a component there.
Yeah.
Not the ideal 40 minutes, but maybe, you know, 20 yep. minutes or so to that. Mm-hmm. But we have been looking then at and because of the problems that we see at the hospital, we have been looking at common grounds for the interprofessional simulation, like ESPAR, closed-loop communication, call-out, teamwork and communicating in that. Mm-hmm. That have been our learning objectives. While we create stressful situations like anaphylaxis or something like that, mm-hmm. and then see how the teamwork goes, how that yeah. works.
Yeah.
And it has been really, I think we have been learning a lot, but it's more problematic really when you have you have many professions mm-hmm. At different levels. How are you going to look at the research? How are you going to see the benefits of the simulation? Because there are still even more confounding variables there. So that has been our problems. Because I have a PhD student who really wants to look at the how to do this, or he is trying to figure out how to look at yeah. what works.
Yeah.
And also we've been looking at the different facilitators because I know that they are not all the same, and how you can sort of take away the differences in the facilitators. I see now having a script for the debriefing and mm-hmm. things like that. We have been in preparing our facilitators. We went to SAFER, you know, in Stavanger here in Norway.
Mm-hmm.
So we are all kind of learned the same way,
right?
But still we are all different.
I know.
And how do you deal with that when you're doing research?
Well, and again, is it fair to connect it all to patient outcomes? Like, I mean, that's exactly. what they want us to do yeah. is show the patient yeah. outcomes. Mm-hmm. And how can you really prove that little 40-minute simulation totally affected. It's not yeah. impossible. And the facilitation and the debriefing are the two that I'm struggling a little bit with now. We're actually going to have out in British Columbia at our May, it's a Western Canadian Health Science Educators, which are all simulationists, come together. We're doing the full day Harvard debriefing. I've attended the DASH model when it was free. I'm going in really skeptical because I think anything that gives you a protocol that you must check all the boxes is just too complicated, and it's not going to work for most of us. The other thing, too, is I did focus a lot on the interprofessional, and I'm trying to think because Monday in a week from yesterday in Akureyri, I'll be doing a conference that we were going to video share on my global information tool. So I'm wondering, I need to get your information, and even here, if there were students or faculty that wanted to video in, I bet we could arrange that, or maybe they are taping it as well and we could share it. But it is important to focus on team training. But for beginning nursing education, and I'm not supposed to use the word but. Sorry, I got that from my perinatal conference last week. No buts. And it is important to reinforce therapeutic relationships. So my tool is entirely on patient-provider, and it is truly looking at therapeutic relationship, empathy, trust and rapport, rapport building and power sharing. So it's very socially just, Canadian, patient-centered, not U.S.-centric at all, with this mind of developing our students to be professionals and communicate in an effective manner. And I think we can do a lot of that. And for those of you who may be skeptical about simulation and what is this and why should we do it, I think we have focused a lot on the acute care because that's where it's been incredibly valuable and we could demonstrate differences. But I think we haven't even begun to touch the surface of the non-technical skills, the palliative care, the emotions, the maintaining our own health as health professionals and as health faculty. I think it's huge, and there's a huge, you'll notice I keep switching to health, because in my environment at UBC, my health professional colleagues, we're all in this together. Our students are all going to be interacting together, and nursing, in my mind, will lead the way. You know, we're the collaborators and the drivers, and we get the work done, but all of our partners are important, critical pieces to the puzzle, and leveraging and respecting how we are all different in our disciplines, and we can stay true to our disciplines, but the patient, that is the center, and that is the lifestyle, their family, the community. How do we make our world a safer, healthier place to live in? Really, that's our ultimate goal. And how do we train this next generation so we have somebody good taking care of us? A little biased, Kristen. Thank you all. I know we're way over time, but we're good. Hi.
Hi, my name is Astrid. And I am in this end-of-life care field. And palliative care has had a lot of attention today.
Yes.
And I'm very happy for that. But my comment was to, in general, how to deal with emotions in the room. Mm-hmm. And I think it's good to normalize. We are human, all of us. Students are human. Patients, mm-hmm. Relatives, everybody. And I think it's something to speak up about that. When I have lectured to students that I know, mm-hmm. it's easier because
yes.
I know them.
Yes.
But when I meet groups of people that I don't know, I normally talk about in this room, maybe somebody is seriously sick, maybe somebody has a relative, maybe somebody of you have losses very close in your life.
Right.
And maybe you get affected of my lecture or what is going on.
Oh, so important.
And that helps a lot. And to talk about this and talk to the students about if you need somebody to talk with, do that. And mm-hmm. I always bring my name on the, you know, so people can get in touch if something has showed up that they need to sort out in a way. Mm.
Are you incorporating trauma-informed care? Is that ringing a bell? Because that's exactly, in North America, we've embraced this concept of trauma-informed care, and we are now educating students, but faculty need to be thinking of it when they're looking at a room of students that just assume every patient you meet has had some life experience that has been traumatic. And it can be as much as, you know, abuse as a child or, you know, exposure to violence or whatever, but it could also be a loss or those other components. So that's really helpful to hear how you express that. And I was sharing with colleagues here, I often would use a miscarriage as an example, and I had one person at the end say, recognize some of us in the room experience this, and it was not pleasant, and it was very hard to just have this shoved like that and talked about so hard. And so I always sort of tried to prepare people, and even with the postpartum hemorrhage, people have had near-death experiences with that we need to be sensitive in describing these. But the humanization We are all humans. And I think I come from my mother's Italian-American side, my father's German-American side, and in between me, the Italians are Portuguese, Brazilians, you know, wide open, embrace the world, and the Germans tend to be very stoic, and sometimes they don't know where I land with that. But my first few years in Canada, I would look out over a group, and there would be no facial response to what I was saying, and I'm like, do I have something on my head? Am I not? And I just realized that's Canadians. They listen very politely, and that, you know, when they're done. But that just had to get used to that response. So I think, again, culturally, we live in a world where a third of my population is Southeast Asian. I've learned more about China, India, incredible cultures, and the richness of the students that I have on campus. That opens up the world for all of us. And then we can help our students to be culturally sensitive to what others are. But it all goes down to the, we share more than we are different. Again, can I say how much I appreciate you allowing me to do this lecture in English and your bravery for sharing your questions and your experience in English, because I know that's incredibly privileged of me to expect that and get it, and I fully appreciate it. And maybe in 5 years we'll have a Google phone that I talk into and you hear me in your own language. Not too far away. Oh, Kristen, sorry.
I would just like to add a comment on your question, what do we do about the facilitators?
Yes.
Different ways of facilitating. In our campus, the last year we have let the facilitator meet and have simulation just colleagues without students.
Ah, oh, brilliant.
And that's a really good way of discussing,
yes,
how do we do
yes,
the briefing and the debriefing, and how to ask the right questions and get the response to each other and get feedback on the job we are doing. And I was wondering if that's...
Yes. Thank you very much. Are there some other comments? Want to share something? Well, okay, thank you. And thank you very much, Susanna, for an amazing and fantastic presentation. And I have a small gift for you. So, thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Thank you very much for coming and for joining this meeting. Thank you very much to Lerdal, who came, and to Lattice using the Sun invitation list, so that we got invitation for all of you, and that was very helpful. And Lada has also helped us a lot during many years, and I think they had many of us, and we are very thankful for that work that you do. So now I think we have come up to an end, and I hope you get some more thoughts and inspiration for your further simulation and work. So, thank you very much. Yeah.